skipping down and continuing. The founding chair of the Republican Heritage Group's council was Laszlo Pastor, an activist in various Hungarian rightist and Nazi-linked groups. In World War II, Pastor was a member of the youth group of the Arrow Cross, the Hungarian equivalent of the German Nazi Party. When Pastor came to the U.S. in the 1950s, he joined the GOP's ethnic division. One of the leaders of the 1968 Nixon-Agnew campaign's ethnic unit, Pastor says that Nixon promised him that if he won the election, he would form a permanent ethnic council within the GOP, as the ethnic division was only active during presidential campaigns. Pastor was made the organizer of the council after Nixon's victory. Pastor claims, quote, "It was my job to identify about 25 ethnic groups," unquote, to bring into the Republican Heritage Group's council, and again quoting, "In 1972, we used the council as the skeleton to build the heritage groups for the re-election of the president," unquote. So again, Hungarian Arrow Cross veteran Laszlo Pastor, the founder of the RHGC. Skipping down and continuing. According to RHGC delegates interviewed during the May 1985 conference in setting up the council, Pastor went to various collaborationist and fascist-minded emigre groups and asked them to form GOP federations. It eventually became clear that it was not an accident or a fluke that people with Nazi associations were in the Republican Heritage Group's council. In some cases, more mainstream ethnic organizations were passed over in favor of smaller but more extremist groups. And it seems clear that the Republican National Committee knows with whom they are dealing. A review of the federations will illustrate this point. We begin by examining the Bulgarian National Front. Blant writes, "One of the organizations which Pastor approached to help form the RHGC was the Bulgarian National Front, headed by Ivan Dochev, D-O-C-H-E-F-F. As early as 1971, the GOP was warned that the National Front was beyond the pale. A Jack Anderson column quoted another Bulgarian-American organization, the Conservative Bulgarian National Committee, which labeled Dochev's National Front as, quote, fascist, unquote. Neither the GOP nor the Nixon campaign took action. Professor Spas T. Raikin, that's S-P-A-S-R-A-I-K-I-N, beginning again, Professor Spas T. Raikin, a former official of the National Front, says the group grew out of an organization in Bulgaria in the 1930s and 1940s that was, quote, pro-Nazi and pro-fascist. The sentence again, Professor Spas T. Raikin, a former official of the National Front, says the group grew out of an organization in Bulgaria that in the 1930s and 1940s was, quote, pro-Nazi and pro-fascist, unquote. Of course, we took a look at Professor Spas T. Raikin, the former Secretary General of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and the individual who met Lee Harvey Oswald upon his return from the Soviet Union. And so, in addition to being the former Secretary General of the American Friends of the ABN, in addition to meeting Lee Harvey Oswald upon his return from the Soviet Union, again, supposedly a Marxist and a traitor to the United States, we find that Spas Raikin, not surprisingly, was a former official of the pro-Nazi and pro-fascist Bulgarian National Front. Continuing, Dochev, age 83, is semi-retired from GOP activity, and the National Front is now represented by Radi Slavov, Republican Heritage Group's Council Executive Director and head of the Bulgarian GOP Federation. Slavov also represents the National Front and several other Washington, D.C. area coalitions, including one that is Nazi-linked. While Dochev was representing the National Front, the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations, or OSI, was investigating him for possible war crimes he was suspected of committing while the mayor of a German-occupied city in Bulgaria. Dochev denies he ever committed war crimes, and the OSI never brought charges. Dochev's political history, however, is not in dispute. Founder of a Bulgarian youth group in the early 1930s, Dochev met with Adolf Hitler and the Nazi movement's leading philosopher Alfred Rosenberg in 1934, shortly after the Nazis came to power. Dochev then established the Bulgarian Legion, a pro-Hitler group that agitated for government action against Bulgarian Jews. So again, apparently, Dochev, in addition to forming the Bulgarian Front, he had met personally with Hitler as well as Alfred Rosenberg, the key architect of Third Reich policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. Continuing with Balint's account, skipping down again, now we're talking about the Archbishop Valerian Trifa of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate, and bear in mind, again, we took a look at him in program number two, RFA number two. We took a look at his association with Richard Nixon and Reinhard Gehlen. Of Trifa and his close associate and defender, Florian Goldau, Balint writes as follows. FBI documents from 1954 and 1955, which were used in the prosecution of Trifa, show that Trifa, quote, is bringing Iron Guard members into the U.S. and installing them as priests. One of these priests, according to a document dated October 5, 1955, was Florian Goldau, whom an FBI source described as, quote, a Romanian Iron Guard member, and who at Trifa's instructions was elected pastor of St. Dumitru, a Manhattan parish, excuse me, that's D-U-M-I-T-R-U. Skipping down again in this particular passage, and bear in mind again that the Romanian Iron Guard were brutal collaborators of the Third Reich, and we took a look at them in a big way, again, in RFA number 2. Now, of Philip Guarino, the honorary member of the P2 Lodge, Balint writes of him as follows. A theology student in Mussolini's Italy in the late 1920s and much of the 1930s, Guarino helped establish the ethnic division of the GOP in 1952. He was vice chair of the Republican Heritage Group's council from 1971 to 75. He attended the 1985 council convention to ensure that his friend, Frank Stella, S-T-E-L-L-A, won the chairmanship of the council in a tight race with former Cleveland Mayor Ralph Perk, P-E-R-K. Guarino was also described in St. Peter's Banker, a book about activities involving P2, as an, quote, honorary member of P2, unquote. Foreign members of P2 were rare. Another member of the select group was José López Rega, R-E-G-A, founder of the Latin American Death Squad group known as the Argentine Anti-Communist Alliance, or AAA. Guarino was also involved in John Connolly's Committee for the Defense of the Mediterranean, which disseminated propaganda on the Italian Communist Party, or PCI, supposed threat to the West. Connolly was Richard Nixon's Secretary of the Treasury and a member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board under Nixon and Gerald Ford. In 1978, Guarino's friend and ally, Frank Stella, became national chair of the, quote, Heritage National Committee of Connolly for President, unquote, when Connolly sought the 1980 GOP nomination for president. Well, of course, John Connolly was governor of Texas when Kennedy was assassinated, was riding in the car with President Kennedy. He later helped block Jim Garrison's investigation by refusing to extradite Sergio Arcacha Smith to New Orleans. And, of course, Richard Nixon, we took a look at his involvement in the assassination of John Kennedy in the Guns of November Part 3, including a massive addendum that I did this past June of 1992. Now, bear in mind again that every president we have had since Kennedy, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, was involved in some way or another with either Kennedy's assassination or its cover-up. LBJ, of course, deeply involved. We've already touched on Richard Nixon. Gerald Ford succeeded Richard Nixon when he had to resign. Gerald Ford, of course, a key member of the Warren Commission. Ronald Reagan helped to block Jim Garrison's investigation by refusing to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to New Orleans, despite the fact that then-Deputy State Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien, who reviewed Garrison's extradition request, recommended that it be granted. Reagan delayed action until after Richard Nixon was elected president, then turned it down without comment. Of course, we've taken a look at, Reagan served on the Rockefeller Commission, examining whether or not there was CIA involvement in the Kennedy assassination. Reagan and others said there was none. There obviously was some. And George Bush, of course, as director of Central Intelligence, helped frustrate congressional investigations into the possible CIA connections of Ruby and Oswald. In addition, George Bush's name crops up in connection with the Kennedy assassination in a number of other ways that the investigation into the assassination in a number of ways that I touched on in the first installment of this archive show. So it's interesting to find Guarino close to John Connolly. Also bear in mind that William Casey, director of the CIA, a good friend of George Bush and his father Prescott Bush Sr., manager of Ronald Reagan's 1980 campaign, later, again, CIA director, a member of the OSS unit that had been working with Galen right at the end of World War II, William Casey is also on the very same President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board with John Connolly under Gerald Ford. And as we'll see, Gerald Ford appointed George Bush to be director of the CIA, and he then again did a number of things, including helping to frustrate congressional investigations into CIA connections to Ruby and Oswald. We'll take a look at George Bush and his tenure as CIA director later. Again, though, note that William Casey is on the same President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board with John Connolly. Again, these connections are to be looked at as an old boy network or a coup group, suit yourself, because that's basically why we find these same individuals cropping up so often. Now, we're going to skip ahead to the 1988 presidential campaign, and we're going to see these same fascist Galen ABN connected elements emerging on George Bush's campaign. And by the way, we looked at this in a miscellaneous archive show that was recorded at the time, called, appropriately enough, Nazis and Anti-Semites on the Bush Campaign. Russ Ballant writes of this as follows: on August 2nd, 1988, many of the key figures in the RHGC were named as leaders of the George Bush presidential campaign's ethnic outreach arm, the Coalition of American Nationalities, or CAN. These included Anna Chenault, A-N-N-A-C-H-E-N-N-A-U-L-T, Walter Melianovich, M-E-L-I-A-N-O-V-I-C-H, Laszlo Pastor, Frank Stella, Roddy Slavoff, Philip Guarino, and Florian Galdow. Other persons on the Bush ethnic panel with questionable views or pasts were Bohdan Fedorok and Aksedis Manjuris. That's spelled B-O-H-D-A-N, F-E-D-O-R-A-K. The second fellow was A-K-S-E-L-I-S, M-A-N-G-U-L-I-S. In September of 1988, Pastor, Slavov, Guarino, Galdow, Fedorok, Brentar, and Ignatius Bilinski resigned from the Bush panel following revelations about their pasts or views appearing in the Washington Jewish Week, Philadelphia Inquirer, and the extended version of this article, which was published by Political Research Associates. By the way, Brentar is B-R-E-N-T-A-R, Ignatius Bilinski, I-G-N-A-T-I-U-S, B-I-L-L-I-N-S-K-Y. Continuing with Ballant's account, Bush advisor Fred Malek, M-A-L-E-K, resigned from the Bush campaign after the Washington Post identified him as having compiled lists of Jews working at the Bureau of Labor Statistics on orders from the Nixon White House. In early November, the Philadelphia Inquirer raised questions about a Latvian member of CAN, which prompted the final resignation, that of Aksedis Manjuris, charged with having belonged to the pro-Nazi Latvian Legion, which had connections to the SS. While Bush campaign spokespersons pledged there would be an investigation into the backgrounds and views of the CAN members whose resignations it had announced, no serious investigation ever took place, and the campaign repeatedly referred to the charges as unsubstantiated, politically motivated smears. Several of the persons who had been reported as resigning told journalists they had never been asked to resign and considered themselves still active with the Bush campaign. Furthermore, Guarino, Slavoff, Galdow, and Pastor are still active with the Republican Heritage Groups Council. As a candidate, President Bush defended Galdow, Pastor, Guarino, and Slavoff as innocent of all accusations of collaboration and insisted they are all honorable men. But the historical record belied his assertions. So again, we are tracing the evolution of these liberation advocates in this liberation milieu right on up through the Republican Party. And bear in mind that some of the Eastern European organizations like Iron Guard, Arrow Cross, Bulgarian Front, OUN were specifically SS collaborationist elements. Again, the Nazis' post-World War II underground plans to be grouped around the SS and Gestapo. Here we see the Galen and ABN groups used to project these same elements into American society. And again, bear in mind that anti-communism, the fear of communism, was basically the way in which these elements were able to wheedle their way into the Republican Party. And we're seeing here yet another evolution of the rollback or liberation milieu. We're going to take a musical break now, and when we come back, we're going to take a look at the Reagan and Bush administrations as the ultimate fulfillments of the Christian West concept, liberation theory, the synthesis of political, economic, and national security activity mandated by NSC 68, and as the ultimate fulfillment of the goals of Rosenberg's Ostministerium from the Third Reich. That after a musical break, then more of Radio Free America program number 37. We're going to continue now with this installment of Radio Free America 37, and we're going to begin taking a look at the Reagan and Bush administrations as the ultimate fulfillment of the Christian West concept, liberation theory, and the doctrine as enunciated in Paul Nitze's NSC 68 again, drawn up during the Truman administration, a Democratic administration realized under the Republican administrations, the arch-Republican administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush, indicating the bipartisan nature of the effects of the Galen Organization, related elements, their sympathetic elements in the United States, on the United States. We're going to begin by looking at another article also from Covert Action Information Bulletins number 33, issue number 33, from the winter of 1990. This particular article was authored by Bob Callahan, C-A-L-L-A-H-A-N. It's entitled, The 1980 Campaign, Agents for Bush. And with the Reagan and Bush administration, we will see the results of the formation of the national security state, the total synthesis of economic, political, and national security activity, which was mandated by NSC 68, which we looked at in detail last week, and which we will touch back on this evening. And again, this administration, these administrations, the fulfillment of that. Now again, economic, political, and military or national security activities have always been deeply related, but the doctrine enunciated under NSC 68, basically the Christian West concept as applied to the United States, that doctrine, the synthesis, the complete synthesis of those three spheres of activity, it resulted in the national security state. The ultimate fulfillment of that state has been realized under the Reagan and Bush administrations. Beginning with Bob Callahan's The 1980 Campaign, Agents for Bush, we're going to take a look at the profound involvement of elements of U.S. intelligence, U.S. intelligence operatives, both past, or quote past, unquote, and present in George Bush's initially abortive drive for the presidency. Callahan writes, On inaugural eve, January 21st, 1981, George Herbert Walker Bush, the new Vice President of the United States, could pause and look back on his own failed presidential campaign and yet feel satisfied knowing that the interests of the intelligence community would be well represented in the new Reagan-Bush administration. A tough Wall Street lawyer and a strong advocate of covert operations, William Casey, was about to be installed as Director of Central Intelligence, or DCI. And George Bush, a former DCI who also had many friends on Wall Street, was just, quote, one heartbeat away, unquote, from the presidency of the United States. I would interrupt in a miscellaneous archive show called George Bush and the Shooting of President Reagan. We took a look at the strong connections between the Hinckley family and the Bush family. Of course, John Hinckley Jr., convicted of attempting to assassinate Reagan. Continuing here with the account. To a great extent, George Bush owed his recent political fortune to several old CIA friends, chiefly Ray Kline, C-L-I-N-E, who had helped to rally the intelligence community behind Bush's candidacy in its early stages. It had been Ray Kline, after all, who had first started the loose organization of, quote, agents for Bush, unquote. Bill Peterson of the Washington Post wrote in a March 1st, 1980 article, quote, simply put, no presidential campaign in recent memory, perhaps ever, has attracted as much support from the intelligence community as has the campaign of former CIA director George Bush, unquote. Again, I'll interrupt, one never becomes director of the CIA and severs one's contacts with the agency. The concept of a quote X unquote CIA agent is always one that must be viewed with a jaundiced eye, but one never becomes director of Central Intelligence and severs contacts with the agency. One simply knows too much. You literally know where the bodies are buried. Continuing. It was true. By the 1st of March, Ray Klein had helped put together an intelligence community campaign support staff of such size, complexity, and character that had the Bush campaign initiated its own covert actions, it undoubtedly had the capacity to bring down at least half the world's governments based on its own past experiences and associations. Note this very interesting statement. By the 1st of March, Ray Klein had helped put together an intelligence community campaign support staff of such size, complexity, and character that had the Bush campaign initiated its own covert actions, it undoubtedly had the capacity to bring down at least half of the world's governments based on its own past experiences and associations. Of course, the Reagan campaign itself came to power in large measure as a result of a covert operation, namely the so-called October Surprise, the apparent deal cut between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. Continuing, George Bush's CIA campaign staff included Klein, CIA chief of station in Taiwan from 1958 through 62, Lieutenant General Sam V. Wilson, and Lieutenant General Harold A. Aaron, capital A-A-R-O-N, both former directors of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Also included was retired General Richard Stilwell, STILLWELL, once the CIA's chief of covert operations for the Far East, and at least 25 other retired company directors, deputy directors, and or agents. It is hard to overestimate the level of CIA support that then existed for Bush's presidential campaign. At the annual meeting of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, or AFIO, the previous fall, Bush's Virginia campaign coordinator and the former director of AFIO, Jack Coakley, C-O-A-K-L-E-Y, claimed to have counted 190 Bush for President buttons being worn by the convention's 240 delegates. CIA support for Bush was apparently not limited to off-duty or retired agents either. One of Bush's earliest supporters, Angelo Codevilla, C-O-D-E-V-I-L-L-A, informed a congressional committee that he was, quote, aware that active duty agents of the Central Intelligence Agency worked for the George Bush primary election campaign, unquote. Codevilla made this statement in a sworn affidavit prepared for a 1984 House investigation. We're going to skip down in the Bob Callahan article, and we're going to take a look at some activities of George Bush when he was director of Central Intelligence. We're going to take a look at some early connections between the Bush family and William Casey. Recall William Casey in charge of all secret intelligence for the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence agency, and part of the OSS faction that was deeply connected with the Galen organization in its early years. Callahan writes, as important as Ray Klein's advice and support had been to George Bush, the real turning point in Bush's quest for the White House came when William Casey convinced Ronald Reagan to choose Bush as his running mate. Recall that Casey was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager. He later became director of CIA, of course. Continuing with Callahan's text, Bush and Casey were, after all, old friends. By 1979, the two had worked closely on a number of intelligence matters for over a dozen years. In 1962, for example, William Casey and Prescott Bush, George's father, co-founded the National Strategy Information Center in New York City. The elder Bush and Casey were both leading Republican conservative members of New York's Wall Street community, and both could claim a background in intelligence matters while members of the U.S. military. In subsequent years, the organization which William Casey and Prescott Bush created became increasingly embroiled in political controversy. The National Strategy Information Center had funded a series of Forum World Features publications until it was publicly revealed that the Forum was a CIA proprietary operating out of London and was engaged in a variety of anti-left disinformation campaigns. The Bush-Casey think tank had also played a pioneering role in establishing chairs and scholarships on numerous U.S. college campuses, where friends of the CIA were able to gain a modicum of intellectual credibility teaching courses on intelligence and national security issues. By the way, let's recall now that Prescott Bush was a very close friend of Henry Neal Mallon, the chairman of the board of Dresser Industries, and it was Henry Neal Mallon who got George Bush his first job with IDECO, a subsidiary of Dresser Industries. And in the Anthony Kimry article in The Company of Friends, numerous intelligence veterans speculated that that was almost certainly, at least in their opinion, a cover for intelligence activities by George Bush. He had no experience in the petroleum industry, and he was immediately used by Dresser Industries, a subsidiary IDECO, to conduct its activities behind the Iron Curtain. Recall also that Prescott Bush Sr., as we looked at last May in an addendum to the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, was deeply involved with a number of companies that were doing business with Nazi Germany and were confiscated by the alien property custodian for doing so. Recall also that Prescott Bush Sr.'s friend Henry Neal Mallon, in addition to getting George Bush his first job with Dresser Industries, was also a very good friend of Alan Dulles, and also a good friend of George de Morenshield, who was also associated with George Bush. De Morenshield, one of Oswald's handlers. Recall that in that same Anthony Kimry article, Dresser Industries was often used as a CIA cover organization, and recall that one of the directors, one of the board members on its board of directors, chaired by Prescott, or by Henry Neal Mallon, was Lewis McNaughton, and Lewis McNaughton was one of the key people of the petroleum engineering firm DeGolyer and McNaughton, some of whose associates, such as George Bowie and Declan Ford and Jack Alston Crichton, were involved with the handling of the Oswalds and were part and parcel to this petroleum industry, intelligence, Galen-related milieu that we began our examination of RFA 37 with. So continuing here, moving from the association of William Casey and Prescott Bush Sr., the Bush-Casey think tank had also played a pioneering role in establishing chairs and scholarships on numerous U.S. college campuses where friends of the CIA were able to gain a modicum of intellectual credibility teaching courses on intelligence and national security issues. And of course, that forum obviously was deeply involved with the CIA. Continuing. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, at Georgetown University was in many ways an outgrowth of the original Bush-Casey think tank. CSIS's illustrious faculty included Henry Kissinger, George Carver, Michael Ledeen, and Ray Klein. William Casey's relationship with young George Bush culminated in 1976 when Casey was appointed to the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board and George Bush was appointed Director of Central Intelligence. Now recall, this is by Gerald Ford, key member of the Warren Commission, sitting on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board with William Casey, is John Connolly, an associate of Philip Guarino. Continuing. It had long been William Casey's contention that the CIA's assessment of Soviet military strength seriously underestimated the potential Soviet threat. In his young friend, Casey finally found a CIA director willing to do something about the problem. What George Bush and William Casey actually did was to form their own study group to provide the CIA with some competitive analysis, a new Team B analysis to contrast with the agency's own standard Team A analysis. Not surprisingly, the new Team B concluded that the CIA had indeed woefully underestimated the real Soviet threat. This argument was, of course, the primary justification for the massive U.S. arms buildup under Reagan. These last couple of sentences again, because they're a key. What George Bush and William Casey actually did was to form their own study group to provide the CIA with some competitive analysis, a new Team B analysis to contrast with the agency's own standard Team A analysis. Not surprisingly, the new Team B concluded that the CIA had indeed woefully underestimated the real Soviet threat. This argument was, of course, the primary justification for the massive U.S. arms buildup under Reagan. Team B was led by George Bush's future advisor, Professor Richard Pipes, P-I-P-E-S, and by General Daniel Graham, who later became a leader in the fight to develop Star Wars technology. Indeed, the entire anti-Soviet, quote, evil empire, unquote, tone of the Reagan administration was set by this group of Bush-Casey analysts. The die, as they say, had been cast. William Casey was entirely aware of this background when he approached the California governor with his recommendation for a vice presidential running mate. While some found George Bush too wimpish for their taste, Casey would not be so easily misled. So again, we have William Casey and Prescott Bush, the same Prescott Bush who's a friend of Henry Neal Mallon of Dresser Industries, himself an associate of Alan Dulles and George DeMoranshield, another associate of George Bush, and recall that Dresser, a frequent cover for intelligence and CIA activities. They form the National Strategy Information Center involved with CIA. William Casey appointed to the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, along with, at the same time, as George Bush is appointed director of the CIA, both appointed by Gerald Ford. And then George Bush brings in a Team B to reassess the dimensions of the Soviet military threat, and in the drastically revised and upgraded estimate of the Soviet military threat, we are seeing a recapitulation of the same process which we saw in the United States in the early 50s with the spurious reports being given by the Galen Organization to the United States, and those reports being received enthusiastically by American Cold Warriors who sought to step up the Cold War, notably the aforementioned Paul Nitze, who used fear of the Soviet threat, and that fear generated in considerable measure by the exaggerated reports being given by Galen, that was used to help justify in the minds of the American people the massive military buildup called for by NSC 68's Paul Nitze. And recall that the CFF program, the Crusade for Freedom, which projected liberation thinking and its exponents into the forefront of American political thinking, Paul Nitze's, that was the propaganda campaign mandated as an element of NSC 68. In assessing the way the Galen Organization has affected this country, two things we should mention, of course, are what perhaps might be called bureaucratic and institutional inertia. If you're going to move up in a government agency and or in the military, basically you're going to have to go along to get along. And with liberation thinking, with the type of thinking that Galen was able to find sympathy with and to a considerable extent manipulate, in order to move up into these institutions, basically it helped enormously to go along with the views of those institutions so that, again, the inertia generated by the bureaucratic institutions within government, both civilian and military, is a key factor in helping to perpetuate this same type of phenomenon. And here again, with William Casey and George Bush and Team B, we are seeing a repetition of the process we saw in the early 50s vis-a-vis Paul Nitze, NSC 68, the Crusade for Freedom, and the formation of liberation theory in order to justify the huge military buildup called for by NSC 68. Now note Professor Richard Pipes of Team B. That's a name we're going to come back to. Bear in mind General Daniel Graham, a leader in the fight to develop Star Wars. We're going to touch on Star Wars later. And above all else, bear in mind that it was the Team B analysis under George Bush while Director of Central Intelligence, working with William Casey, that set the stage for the massive military buildup under Ronald Reagan. We're going to take a look at another member of this Team B analysis group. Research credit on the following article goes to a listener. This is from Harper's Magazine of October of 1991. In the capital letter section, there's an article entitled Unlawful, Unelected, and Unchecked, subtitled How the CIA Subverts the Government at Home, and it's authored by Christopher Hitchens, H-I-T-C-H-E-N-S. And skipping down, in Hitchens' account, we find of the Team B, we're going to find a familiar name here in addition to the aforementioned Richard Pipes and Daniel Graham. Hitchens writes, "It was also Director Bush who used the agency to tighten the ratchet of 70s anti-commie paranoia by appointing Team B to second-guess the annual intelligence estimates. Team B, made up of Paul Nitze, Richard Pipes, Lieutenant General Daniel Graham, and others of similar stamp, is perhaps best remembered for its belief in the unfalsifiable superstition that Moscow sought and could obtain strategic superiority. Out of this smoke came the atmospherics of Reaganism." So we find Paul Nitze himself, Mr. NSC 68 himself, Mr. Crusade for Freedom himself, coming back on Team B, and with Team B's overestimates of Soviet military strength, we find a recapitulation of the Galen NSC 68 military buildup phenomenon, which called for the Crusade for Freedom projection of liberation theory and proponents into American political life. And as we shall see, we'll take a look at the Reagan administration as the ultimate fulfillment of the Christian West concept, liberation theory, and NSC 68. We're going to turn again to Covert Action Information Bulletins issue number 41, and we're going to reread parts of NSC 68, this from an article called "The U.S. Economy, the Enemy Within" by Doug Henwood, H-E-N-W-O-O-D. Now again, during the Truman administration, the impending end of the Marshall Plan in 1952 was seen as representing a threat in a number of ways, chiefly the threat of a U.S. economic slowdown and a corresponding European economic slowdown as well. The Marshall Plan, too, as I mentioned last week, should be seen in the context of the Christian West concept. To counteract that possibility, and to also further realize the strategic aims of the United States, NSC 68 called for a military buildup of enormous proportions to prime the U.S. economic pump with a sort of military Keynesianism, to weaken the Soviet Union by forcing them to match it, and also to stimulate the world economy as well with this massive outflow of U.S. national security dollars, as well as a stimulation of nationalism in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and a crackdown on dissent. And in a very prescient short passage of The Enemy Within by Doug Henwood, he writes, "The Reagan presidency, essentially an intensified rededication to the principles of NSC 68, was its utopia. The huge military buildup was designed to intimidate and bankrupt the Soviet Union, while at the same time smashing any number of third world pests. It did both. The Pentagon helped power a mad and highly selective economic boom that massively increased the global prestige of capitalism as Soviet-style systems were failing." And again, we're going to look at now the Reagan administration as the ultimate fulfillment of Christian West, the liberation theory, and the principles of NSC 68, and bear in mind that it was the Team B analysis under George Bush as Director of Central Intelligence, in combination with William Casey, dating back to the old Galen Associations of OSS, associate of George Prescott Sr. It was that Team B assessment involving Richard Pipes, who we're going to look at, and Paul Nitze, the architect of NSC, who we've already looked at. It was that Team B analysis which laid the groundwork for the Reagan-Bush administrations. Now, an X factor in assessing the Reagan and Bush administrations concerns the relationship between Otto von Bolschwing, a key SS officer, war criminal, and Galen operative, and a woman named Helena von Damm. We took a look at this in Radio Free America number 3. Now, Helena von Damm had a, quote, social relationship as well as a professional relationship with Otto von Bolschwing, again, a key Galen operative who also set up an organization parallel to Galen's in the United States. And Helena von Damm selected all, she drew up the lists from which all of Ronald Reagan's appointments were made when he was governor of California. She then jumped to the White House with Reagan and became a special White House executive director for presidential personnel. She performed the same function under Ronald Reagan. She also, incidentally, came to the United States when she married a member of the same military intelligence unit of a former Reagan National Security Advisor, William Clark. And although that's by no means definitive, One technique used by the intelligence community to get people from one country or another is to effect a marriage of convenience and then a subsequent divorce once the person has been relocated. That does not mean that Helena von Damm was such an individual, but it's a possibility that should be looked into. But again, von Damm draws up the list from which all of Reagan's appointments are made. She had a, quote, social relation, or, quote, new socially, unquote, Otto von Bolschwing, also did some translating for Otto von Bolschwing's company, TCI, a subsidiary of which, International Imaging Systems, later became a part of Stanford Technology, used by Albert Hakim and others in the Iran-Contra scandal. And again, bear in mind that the Reagan and Bush administrations, the Reagan administration, I should say, with William Casey, later CIA director, as campaign manager, with George Bush, former CIA director under whose tutelage the Team B people came to power, that administration came to power as a result of a covert operation. We're going to take a look, and oh, by the way, bear in mind also that the early career, political career of Ronald Reagan was heavily supported by the American Security Council and the personages of people like William Frawley and Henry Salvatore. The American Security Council itself, deeply involved with the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and growing out of the Harry Young American Vigilant Intelligence Federation, which collaborated with the Hitler Goebbels anti-Comintern, and with which it was recommended or was suggested by Kurt Rees and the Nazis go underground in 1944, a residual Third Reich should hook up. Turning again to Blowback by Christopher Simpson, with his very prescient analysis of the Reagan administration as the ultimate fulfillment of liberation thinking. More important than any organizational connections, however, is the manner in which liberation thinking has again taken hold in Washington, D.C. The Reagan wing of the Republican Party has historically maintained extremely close ties with the captive nations movement. Many top Reagan activists have spent much of their lives promoting the liberationist cause, even when the theory fell out of fashion after the Hungarian uprising of 1956. Continuing, President Reagan himself bestowed a Medal of Freedom, the country's highest civilian honor, on liberation theorist and former OPC CIA emigre program consultant James Burnham, B-U-R-N-H-A-M, in 1983. Burnham's liberation analysis, quote, profoundly affected the way America views itself and the world, unquote, Reagan intoned at the awards ceremony, and again quoting, and I owe him a personal debt, the president continued, again quoting, because throughout the years of traveling on the mashed potato circuit, I have quoted him widely, unquote.